Welcome back to another In the Flesh episode of The Real House. I am not divided by the cold, unfeeling internet. I'm joined in person by my idiot brother, DJ Wheeler. How are you, DJ?
Oh, I'm fantastic. It's great to be here for another one of these In the Flesh editions. My brother, my captain, my king.
As usual, we have a full-length review, and that's going to be of Star Trek Into Darkness. But before we get into that, we are going to run through our usual segments, the first being the Minority Report, where we talk about the media we've been consuming recently. And after that, we're going to segue into the Mr. Holland's Opuses segment, where we talk about the music we've been listening to recently. While I'm on that subject, the intro, outro, and break music for the show is going to come from those records. That's Endless Fantasy by Anna Monoguchi and One of Us is the Killer by the Dillinger Escape Plan. But enough of that. DJ, I have to ask you, where is your Minority Report, and do you even have one?
Yeah, it turns out that I do have a Minority Report, and this week it's Baz Luhrmann's adaptation of The Great Gatsby. Now, I did not walk into this movie with what I would call an abundance of optimism. I'll not spend too much time expounding upon the fact that Fitzgerald's novel is probably one of my cinematic adaptation no-fly zones. So I expected my primary source of entertainment would be keeping track of how many times old F. Scott rolled over in his grave. But I gotta be honest, this movie was a pleasant surprise. Baz Luhrmann turns out to be the right guy for the job in adapting the Roaring Twenties aesthetic. His modus operandi of spending as much money as humanly possible on set design ends up paying dividends in kind of rendering this revisionist dreamscape of the Roaring Twenties that's some kind of cross between Kanye West and your high school history class. Every single shot is saturated with so much visual detail that it probably passes beyond the threshold of what the human eye can actually perceive, and that points toward probably the biggest problem with this film. Trev, a few months ago, the two of us reviewed a film called The Turin Horse here on The Real House. That movie is 146 minutes long and composed of only 30 shots. Baz Luhrmann's adaptation of The Great Gatsby is the polar opposite of The Turin Horse. I'm not exaggerating when I say that very few of the shots in this film last more than 5 seconds. I can think of two possible explanations for this. Either Luhrmann wanted to make sure he captured like every single detail of this crazy spectacle he created, or he just simply lost interest in his own movie while he was making it. And at first, this frantic cutting is like overwhelming and disorienting. The compulsive side of me was trying to actually count the number of shots that lasted more than 5 seconds. But thankfully, by like the 1 hour mark, your mind will have adapted to the movie's frantic cadence. And it was at that point that I actually started to enjoy other aspects of the movie beyond the lavish set design. Most notably, the character adaptations themselves. Luhrmann's screenplay works with DiCaprio's performance to paint a picture of Gatsby that's far more human than the character in the novel. In the novel, he's kind of like this, almost like a superhero, kind of like an unattainable ideal. Here in the movie, he's kind of fidgety and nervous about meeting Daisy, to the point of full-on slapstick comedy, where he's like bumping into furniture and making a complete fool of himself. The movie is quite a bit funnier than I would have anticipated, and I think the creative choices to use a lighter, more playful tone really breathe life into what could have been a pretty corporate adaptation used to sell a few more Lana Del Rey records. Unfortunately, that tone is not particularly focused, and when Gatsby's world starts to fall apart in the third act, DiCaprio's performance slides from kind of charmingly befuddled to something more strident, to the point where I was eventually rooting against Gatsby, and I don't really ever remember feeling that way when I read the book. The other performances don't really strike me to any great degree. Tobey Maguire's Nick Carraway is indistinguishable from his Peter Parker, and Joel Edgerton's more or less hamming it up as generic 20s aristocrat. Carey Mulligan does a decent job, and I actually think Elizabeth Debicki fits the role of Jordan Baker fairly well. So all in all, this movie is not nearly the train wreck that it very well could have been. It is absurdly direct in handling some of Fitzgerald's underlying themes, but as you'll notice in our main review for this week, I really enjoy a simply fun time at the movies, and Gatsby delivered that. Trav, have you heard anything about this one?
Yeah, I've heard of it. I mean, for someone who's a fan of the novel like me, is there a reason that I should seek out this thing? You know, I kind of missed it in the theaters just because I was afraid of seeing one of my favorite books destroyed on screen, whether or not that's actually the case. Is there a point in my going back and finding it? Is it something that's going to be that worth it or no?
Yeah, I think it may actually be worth it because there are kind of two routes to take with an adaptation, right? And the first is, like, if you're a super fan of a particular material like I am with Game of Thrones and it drives you absolutely nuts whenever something gets changed, then you want the adaptation to be a perfect rendition of what your reading of the book was like. Whereas with The Great Gatsby, it was kind of the other side of the fence where the adaptation can be kind of just like a general means of conveying the same ideas and emotions and thoughts that you remember maybe from reading the book a long time ago. Gatsby definitely falls into that camp. And those types of adaptations, what I like to see is kind of taking a new bent with the material. If you're going to change things, then maybe put your own slant and spin on it. And Baz Luhrmann definitely did that. I mean, I kind of mentioned the set design is definitely his own. You'll see a lot of the Moulin Rouge, kind of Romeo and Juliet style that he has. And then even the comedy. I mean, I don't remember really laughing at any of the parts in the book, but it is a very funny movie. And so, I mean, if you're a Gatsby purist, you will probably hate the movie. But if you, like me, read the book a long time ago and just kind of have some general appreciation of it, you probably will like this adaptation. It may be worth seeking out, so...
All right, maybe I'll go check it out.
Yeah, so Trav, can I ask you now, where is your Minority Report, and do you even have one?
Yeah, a little while ago I saw Upstream Color. This is a new film from Shane Carruth, who listeners might know as the director, actor, writer of, etc., of Primer. His second film, where he also shares about the same number of roles, is Upstream Color. Now, I don't understand this movie. But I think that's a good thing, right? I mean, DJ, you've talked before about how much of a joy it is for a movie to be smarter than you, and that's definitely the sort of feeling I'm getting here. It's great to have a movie that's sort of a puzzle that you're trying to piece together, sort of an enigma unfolding in front of you. So while I can't really articulate exactly... the general effect just yet, I think it'll help me in doing so if I just sort of zoom in on some of the smaller stuff. He does this interesting thing where a lot of time is spent intercutting in scenes. There'll be different actions occurring in different locations, and almost every scene will be two different actions occurring in different locations, cutting between them, so that the times he does actually change scenes, it doesn't feel like a hard cut because you've been cutting and it wasn't a break in the action. So it creates this effect where none of the scenes feel separate from each other. So the movie sort of washes over you. There's this sort of like monistic drowsiness that keeps occurring where the movie just keeps going and you're just kind of sitting there experiencing it. So that when he does have hard cuts, he'll fade to black and then cut back. Those you notice those a lot, and it draws a lot of attention to those spots in the movie. So structurally, the movie's really interesting. And while I'm talking about editing, there's this concept called elliptical editing where, you know, the classic example is someone's getting out of their car and you cut when they're reaching for the handle to when they're out of the car. You know, you cut the boring stuff so you make the stupid actions faster so you get to what's really going on. But what Carruth does here is he does elliptical editing on the stuff you want to see, and he lingers on what we would classically consider the more boring actions in the scene. And it's kind of cool because the whole movie has that sort of passive feel to it on purpose. So it's got it further emphasizes that in this sort of flipping of that classical concept. In general, the cinematography feels really meticulous. There's an intention to about everything you're seeing. Under the performances, I think they're good. Both the leads are good. They're understated, but sometimes to a fault. I don't feel like I understand these people or their actions. And part of that is because of the plot. I can't distinguish their own actions from the ones that are influenced by this main plot device, which I won't spoil. And I guess that's the point, but that makes it really hard for me to really care about these people when I'm not even sure if their actions are truly their own. I guess if you see the movie, you'll understand what I'm saying. I'm not sure if I would still like this movie if I understood the concepts behind it. It's sort of the impenetrability of the concepts here that draw me. Ultimately, though, I think the general effect here is really tremendous. The movie just sort of takes you over, and it excels, much due to the score, which is great. It excels at placing the audience in the exact mood the movie requires at each point. And it sort of, DJ, you mentioned this earlier, that it sort of takes the plot complexity from Primer and replaces it with a conceptual complexity, because it's hard to tell what's going on the thematic level here. But there's definitely something of substance, and so I'd say it's a definite recommendation. DJ, I know you saw this too. What are your thoughts on Upstream Color?
Yeah, it's a total recommendation for me as well. Probably one of the best movies I've seen this year. And the interesting thing, you probably noticed we've not really discussed much of like the actual plot of this movie, because on first blush, you will probably feel like this is an experimental film. As Trav mentioned, it kind of has a dream logic to the way it's cut together. And the interesting thing is that as you begin to dive deeper into the movie, you begin to realize it's not an experimental film. Everything about the core concept is strictly systematic. There is a defined set of rules in the way this world works and the way these events are playing out. It's just so bizarre that it approaches kind of experimental filmmaking, kind of abstract style cinema. But yeah, I like what you said, Trav, about this idea of elliptical editing and kind of flipping that on its head, because it kind of highlights the particular neuroses of these characters. Mm-hmm. They tend to focus on the more mundane elements, like hearing like water rushing through a pipe and, oh, now I got to tear out this wall to get at the pipe or whatever it may be. But yeah, so this movie, I think it's worth stating, is absolutely gorgeous. Yeah. I picked up the DVD Blu-ray combo pack, and usually when I watch a movie, I have my notepad open next to me to just take notes for the podcast, and I hit play, and then like 2 hours of later, I hadn't written down a single word because I was just completely mesmerized by the movie. And the movie that it actually most reminded me of was not Primer. It was a movie that we both enjoyed from last year, Beyond the Black Rainbow, particularly because it is straight up out there. It is very bizarre, and there is some absolutely gorgeous imagery in here that uses kind of like saturated colors, and you're kind of looking at it like, how did they film this shot? Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, to your point, this is a very good film. It's very challenging. I think I expressed to you before that there are some parts of this movie that do approach like student film level of, you know, experimentalism and being abstract, and you're like, okay, I kind of see what you're going for there, but this is a bridge too far. But all in all, it's like a very cohesive, if not disorienting, experience that kind of just begs to be seen. So you most definitely have to check out Upstream Color this year.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I would be surprised if someone who's even interested in this, you know, someone who may, if you liked Primer, you'll probably like this. Just expect that it's not going to be as cohesive and rational as Primer was. Even as complex as that movie is, it's complex in a completely different sort of way. But I think if you enjoyed that, and yeah, DJ, I thought the Beyond Black Rainbow comparison is good too. If either of those movies are ones you're fond of, or if you're just in for a bit of a mind blow, I think you could enjoy Upstream Color. But I think that's enough on our Minority Reports. When we come back from the break, we're going to talk about the records we've been listening to recently in the Mr. Holland's Opuses segment of the show. So here's a clip from one of those albums.
Welcome back to The Real House, the elephant graveyard of film criticism. I am DJ Wheeler, and I'm joined, as always, by my brother, my captain, my king, Travis Wheeler, and the two of us are about to move into a segment of the show we call Mr. Holland's Opuses, wherein We discuss some of the new records we've been listening to lately in hopes that we can recommend them to you guys, our listeners. So, Trav, can I ask you once again, what new opus has Mr. Holland composed for you this week?
I picked the... Cut that out. I picked up the new Onomatoguchi album, Endless Fantasy. Onomatoguchi is a chiptune band, and what that means is that they use old video game hardware. Onomatoguchi uses a Nintendo, but some groups use like a Game Boy or a Commodore 64. And the chiptune genre uses those hardware for a sort of dated electronica sound. And there's sort of a bit of a dichotomy in where these groups tend to go towards. On the one hand, you have groups like MN and Glomig that tend towards a more groove, or not groove oriented, but like ambient oriented sound that's just sort of a cacophony of all these different beeps and bloops that don't really end up forming that much of a melody or thing. That's just sort of experimenting with the hardware. And on the other side, you have groups like Onomatoguchi, Animal Style is another good example of this, that are going towards using this hardware to make pop music or really catchy rhythms, sort of taking the abilities and limitations that using these things as instruments grants you and trying to make really catchy music. And Onomatoguchi has always landed in that second group. Their previous work is an album called Dawn Metropolis, and then they also did the soundtrack for the Scott Pilgrim video game. While there are similar songs here in Endless Fantasy, we've seen in Dawn Metropolis, with that sort of they have a sort of like melody, counter-melody interplay in a lot of their songs. The focus in this album, Endless Fantasy, is on creating a groove on which the melody is going to ride. The title track Endless Fantasy and another track called Planet are really good examples of this. Because of that focal shift, the album veers dangerously close to like top 40 territory, especially in the tracks that experiment with adding vocals. There's a couple of those, one called Japan Air, another called Prom Night. The former even has, probably ironically, but it has a moment where someone yells, "Drop the bass," which, as you might imagine, is quite a red flag for me. Despite that, however, and you know, both of these songs kind of I didn't like at first because it did just sound like a generic pop song to me, but then I realized that Onomatoguchi is so good at crafting these great melodies and hooks that these songs might have first come off as a bit pedestrian, but they end up being sort of my favorite tracks on the album, simply because that chiptune sound allows them to just sort of do things with the pop genre that you can't do in sort of with a mainstream instrumentation. But chiptune diehards shouldn't be afraid, though. There are a lot of straight-ahead NES jams. There's one track called John Hughes, another called Meow, and one called Space Wax America that show Onomatoguchi have not only evolved in the variety of tracks that they're making, but also in the ability to do what they've always done best. They do that even better. It's not all perfect, though. There are some misses here and there. There's one track called Viridian Genesis that just never really goes anywhere. Another one called The Chobo, and one track called Everything Explodes. They all sort of fail to make that much of an impression on me. That sort of gets to the main problem with the album, is that it's 22 tracks long. Oof. And even though chiptune tracks tend on the shorter side, it's a little hard to be able to connect to each one when there's just so much material in front of you. In all honesty, a lot of those could have been taken out. But I might be the exact age and demographic for the target audience of this sort of thing, you know, that video game influence. But the general effect of this album is really cool, and I think Onomatoguchi is really interesting. And I guess I should have mentioned earlier that what Anna Monoguchi does that's different than other chiptune artists is that they introduce live instruments as well. So Anna Monoguchi will have an electric guitar and a drum set in addition to the NES making that sound. And so they're sort of bridging the gap between sort of this fringe genre that's just sort of figuring out what it is and the mainstream. And I think they're very good at utilizing what they can out of the that chiptune experience without losing sort of the human element of music. And for that, I will continue listening to what Anna Monoguchi has to offer, and I would recommend Endless Fantasy to our listeners. DJ, have you caught anything from this album?
I've heard a couple of the clips that you played for me, and it has made me curious, especially what you mentioned about those tracks featuring the vocals being the ones that grew on you most, particularly because one of the things that's always challenged me about Anna Monoguchi is that while at first it's definitely an engaging listen and kind of activates the nostalgia centers in your brain for like all those video games you used to play as a kid and think like, oh yeah, this music's just as awesome as like as popular music, and it's like why isn't this on the radio and stuff like that. But I always felt like there was kind of like that missing human element there, and Anna Monoguchi were always kind of on the threshold of that, as you mentioned, actually having analog instruments or like an electronic guitar or like a drum set. And so does the integration of those vocals take them the next step into kind of transcending the, I guess, less organic, maybe more artificial nature of chiptune into something that's more palatable to mainstream audiences?
I think it does. This, like I said, this album is also focused more on sort of creating a groove, and I think that's more what mainstream pop music tries to do, right? Is create something that's not only catchy, but you also enjoy listening to just for the, the melody isn't enough, right? You also need a bedding to lie there, and I think Anna Monoguchi is trying to master that here, and making these things feel like something you could play just in like a party setting or something, and have it not feel that out of place in with the rest of that sort of dance music catalog, but also be very good at doing that sort of thing within their particular niche. I think that's definitely the case. DJ, what has Mr. Holland been composing for you this week?
Yeah, so many years ago when I first heard the Dillinger Escape Plan's seminal album Calculating Infinity, not in a million years would I have guessed that the same band that produced mathcore freakouts like The Running Board and Sugar Coated Sour would...
43% burnt!
Yeah, would in 2013 release an album that would become my straight-up summer jam. this record is called One of Us is the Killer, and for my money, it is to date the best marriage of the Dillinger Escape Plan's emotional intensity and technical virtuosity. You can basically bifurcate the group's discography into the Dimitri Minakakis era and the Greg Puciato era, the former being defined by unparalleled technicality, and the latter embracing an appreciation of melody that at times approaches something mistakable for radio potential. I'd recently been a little concerned about the band's trajectory because their most recent release, Option Paralysis, was largely identical to 2007's Ironworks, and really the only difference was that Option Paralysis wasn't quite as good as Ironworks. So when One of Us is the Killer announced itself with the huge vocal hook of its opening seconds, I started to get really excited that these guys had found their momentum again. The way that the opening single balances syncopated rhythms atop low-to-high interval jumps in the bass line reminds me of that Rage Against the Machine track, Bulls on Parade, and it's almost enough to get me up and dancing. Trav, I've described this album as obeying the comedy rule of three. Every time it delivers a tasty lick or riff, they return to that riff not once, but at least two more times, and as a result, this record quickly becomes a total crowd pleaser. Such is the case with the thrice repeated chorus of the title track, a song that seemed oddly familiar to me the first few times through, until I realized that that sense of familiarity was attributable to the fact that the song fits the template of those pop songs that play during the opening credits of James Bond movies.
Huh.
It's got the restrained plaintive verses, an unforgettably massive chorus, and lyrics like, one of us must die and shoot your arrow through me and stuff. This title track is accompanied by other mostly melodic numbers like Nothing's Funny and my favorite track, Paranoid Shields. But Escape Plan skillfully alternates these more palatable tracks with the bristling savagery of mathcore power packs like Hero of the Soviet Union, Understanding Decay, and the truly terrifying second track, When I Lost My Bet. If you want to be really freaked out, go on YouTube and watch the music video for the song When I Lost My Bet.
Not for the weak of heart.
Exactly. I think throughout the course of this album, the Dillinger Escape Plan have essentially become a genre unto themselves. The music is simply too much fun to be mathcore, but it's probably not going to be getting any radio play either. Which is why this record works so well for me. It's found that sweet spot between technicality and melody that has occasionally eluded the group in previous efforts. Sure, they can bust out multiple time signatures over the course of only a few bars, but they also know the value of a straight-ahead 2-4 rock beat. I'll grant that the record has a few pacing issues. It doesn't finish quite as strong as it starts, and clearly favors momentum and energy over any kind of cohesive structure. But I'm not sure I want the Dillinger Escape Plan to be producing concept albums anyway. The record is One of Us is the Killer. It's amazing. Go out and buy it. Trev, I know you've listened to this one. What are your thoughts?
I really like it as well. And I like what you were saying about how they sort of have found their own genre, because they were sort of one of the pioneers of the mathcore subgenre. And that first album, Calculating Infinity, I respected it as being sort of the pinnacle of what that genre can be, but it's just too darn hard to listen to. It's there's just too much rhythmic experimentation and all this sort of thing that as cool and as great of an example of how cool that music can be, it's just a painful album to get through. And I love what the Dillinger Escape Plan have become since then, in that they take that energy and that style, but they sprinkle in some tasty and agreeable hooks in there too, for you to sort of catch your breath but also still be really entertained, and they do a really good job of that here, and so for that reason I really like the album. I have the same one regret that you do, in that I don't like the sort of the structure of the album. I don't like the ordering of the songs. I think the title track, One of Us is the Killer, really needs to be the closer. I think it makes way more sense that way, because as it is, the closer, which is, the threat posed by nuclear weapons, isn't that good of a final song, and when the album ends, you just, it's just, oh, I guess this list of songs I've been listening to has ended, not this record they released is completed, and this piece of artwork I've been consuming over the past however long it is finished. It makes the album feel like more of a collection of songs than as a cohesive experience. Like I sort of get with, you mentioned 2007's Ironworks, which, although it sort of has misses in these sort of like weird ambient sections, at least feels like a complete experience. And sort of I tend towards liking that a little bit more, but I can't deny that tracks like Prancer and the title track and Nothing's Funny are just amazing. So I definitely recommend picking this one up too. DJ, any more words on Dillinger Escape Plan before we take a break and move into Star Trek Into Darkness?
Nope. Let's boldly go where no podcast has gone before.
Except all the other podcasts that have reviewed this before us. And we're back to the Real House with Deej and Trav, just about to get into our full-length review of Star Trek Into Darkness. Now, DJ, both of us are big fans of the previous Star Trek film, simply titled Star Trek, and we like sort of the, or at least I enjoyed sort of the, its ability to reboot but still be connected to the rest of the series and to just be a really cool action movie. DJ, how does this sort of new timeline, how does this new franchise work in this sequel? Does it continue to have that cool energy of the first one, or does it sort of fall flat?
It definitely has the energy of the first film still totally intact. And for my money, if I had to sit down and choose which of these two Star Trek reboots I wanted to watch maybe on a Saturday afternoon, I think every time I would choose Star Trek Into Darkness. I really enjoyed this movie. And I'm going to sound like a really big hypocrite here this week, because in our previous episode, I spent most of the review railing on Iron Man 3 for having a totally contrived and incomprehensible plot that abandoned its own internal logic for the sake of being able to cram in just a few more action set pieces. And now I'm going to spend the entirety of this review talking about how great Star Trek Into Darkness is, because it has a totally contrived and incomprehensible plot that abandons its own internal logic for the sake of being able to cram in just a few more action set pieces. This latest installment in J.J. Abrams' reboot of the Star Trek franchise is completely and utterly absurd. And the problem is all the script. Characters make decisions that if they just thought about for a few minutes, they'd realize are completely foolish. And it's especially problematic because we as an audience are supposed to believe that Starfleet is comprised of the galaxy's best and brightest, right? I mean, like, you've got Spock and Uhura and Captain Kirk. When it comes right down to it, this movie isn't a whole lot different than J.J. Abrams' first Star Trek. A bad guy attacks Starfleet, and Starfleet chases after the bad guy. Now, I really enjoyed that Star Trek reboot, but I always found myself wishing it had been just a little bit crazier. It always felt a little safe to me. Star Trek Into Darkness delivers every bit of that additional craziness I was looking for, so this movie totally worked for me. I've seen it twice now, and I've loved it both times. So having felt that way, I was kind of obligated to try and puzzle out why this movie, making all the same mistakes as Iron Man, didn't enrage me nearly the same way. I think the answer lies in the overall spirit of the two films. Iron Man 3 is all about being smug and sarcastic and cynical, like the scene where Tony Stark makes fun of a kid for having an absentee father. Star Trek, on the other hand, is about the spirit of adventure. We get a number of scenes with characters waxing romantic about Starfleet's purpose in exploring the galaxy. And while it may all be a little bit silly, I think I prefer Star Trek's optimism to Iron Man's smugness. Really, the best thing I could hope for in Into Darkness was that it would have the same sense of fun camaraderie that the first reboot had. And in that sense, it totally delivers. The banter between Spock, Kirk, Uhura, Scotty, and Bones is sharp and it's witty, and hardly any of it falls flat, due in large part to the skill of these actors. Zachary Quinto was born to play Spock. I mean, Trekkies might barbecue me for this, but I think he plays an even better Spock than Leonard Nimoy does. And then Carl Urban's Bones McCoy is actually the greatest single thing about this movie. He totally commits to the, like, colloquialisms, using his great, like, rubbery facial expressions. And my goodness, Benedict Cumberbatch, after spending all that time practicing his restrained psychosis in BBC's Sherlock, here he gets to cut loose as a complete sociopath, swerving from, like, well-coiffed 1 minute to raving with spittle flying out of his lips another. I've already made some passing references to this movie's problems, and since I've gathered, Trav, that you're not quite as hot on this movie as I am, I'll probably leave most of those to you. I will point out that this movie continues the troubling trend of, like, ending immediately once the threat is resolved, which only serves to accentuate the fact that the film has no greater ambition than, hey, watch these good guys try to catch this bad guy. But like I said, the best that this series offers is a great sense of camaraderie, and on that front, the movie doesn't disappoint. I read some article where someone involved in the film described it as the franchise's Empire Strikes Back, and it is certainly not that. but unlike Iron Man 3, it is an example of how to make a truly satisfying summer blockbuster. So I really enjoyed it. It gets my recommendation. Trav, I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are.
Yeah, this is a movie that has being really cool as its prime directive. From the stark visual contrast in the opening action set piece to Benedict Cumberbatch just going ham with Space's version of a minigun, the movie has a bit of every type of badassery. That being said, the movie is also quite a mess, which you alluded to. The first, like, 20 minutes of the movie only serve to, one, look cool, and two, make a single point about the Kirk-Spock relationship, which could have just been easily established.
And that point, never trust a Vulcan.
And that point, it could have been easily established by just having these characters talk to each other once. Instead, we get this whole albeit cool action scene that takes way too long, making the movie, like, structurally unsound. And the problems don't quite end there. The villain's motive doesn't quite make sense at the end of the movie. It makes sense at the beginning, but sort of his problem is at one point gone, and he still is villainous. So it's sort of confusing there as to character motivation. There are characters who are complete ciphers, that they're just there to ask audiences questions. There's some plot details that I'll get into spoilers that sort of fall through. And Deej, I don't know why but Bones is just obnoxious in this movie.
Oh, come on, man.
It's just every single one of his lines is just, this guy, am I right? And it just didn't, it didn't do that as much for me as it did for you. But somehow, I still find myself really liking this movie. Chris Pine's Kirk is just as fun to be around as he was in the first movie. Zachary Quinto gives a really solid performance to Spock. And Benedict Cumberbatch is just scarfing down scenery left and right. His performance alone is worth the price of admission. And J.J. Abrams' visual style is refreshing as always. And the action, what, you know, we're all coming to see, is really tight, and the hand-to-hand fight choreography in particular is massively exciting. I found myself having like a vocal reaction to some of the action set pieces here. So the movie's sure to bother some of the more OCD-leaning audience members with its giant plot sweeps that could be replaced with a line or two of dialogue and the logical jumps it takes to get from set piece to set piece. But the sheer impact and fun that the film has makes it a recommendation from me. DJ, you want to respond to anything I said before we jump into spoilers?
Not in particular. I mean, I basically agree with every single criticism you have, with the possible exception of Carl Urban's Bones McCoy.
He does a fine job, but there's no line that he has that is of any import except complaining about what Kirk is doing.
You don't rob a bank while the getaway car's got a flat tire!
I could do without the metaphors. So we'll get into spoilers now. Spoilers for Star Trek Into Darkness. So, did Khan make the ship's engine not work? Because why did he know that was the problem?
In the,
Because he's in that cell, and he's like, oh, it's a problem with the science word, right? And it was.
I think what he was saying there is that, like, he was thinking so many steps ahead, he had deduced that Starfleet would sabotage the Enterprise's engine to leave them stranded on the edge of Klingon space, so that when the Klingons get hit with the torpedoes, they would find a Starfleet ship on the edge of Klingon space to trigger the war that Admiral Marcus wanted. So I have seen this movie twice now, and yeah, the first time through, like, there's a part right at the end of the second act where basically everything gets revealed of what's going on here in the story, and it happens in, like, the course of a single discussion. It happens very quickly. The first time through, I was like, I did not catch all of that. And the second time through, by the end of the movie, I kind of puzzled it together. So the second time through, it started to make some semblance of sense to me. But yeah, so the idea is that Starfleet sabotages the Enterprise to essentially precipitate the war that Admiral Marcus wants. It's kind of a Tomorrow Never Dies, Elliot Carver scenario.
That makes a little more sense to me now. So my second little thing in spoilers, I liked the sort of interplay it has with the Wrath of Khan, sort of mirroring things that happened in that movie. And it's cool to see Leonard Nimoy again. But am I right in that conversation between Spock and Spock Prime amounts to literally nothing?
That's true. I mean, actually, no. So what happens is that, in Trekkies, again, will have to forgive me here, because I was like 7 years old when I first saw The Wrath of Khan. But so what happens in The Wrath of Khan, and I guess spoilers for that movie, is there's a similar gambit made. Kirk makes a deal with Khan that Khan thinks is working in his favor, but Kirk has actually kind of bluffed him or something, and that's how he defeats Khan. So Spock, in the reboot, okay. Spock is now doing that. So we don't see it happen on screen, but Spock Prime explains to Zachary Quinto the gambit that Kirk had to make in his universe to defeat Khan. So Spock does the same thing. He removes the other human popsicles from the torpedoes, sends them back to Khan, and basically detonates his Dreadnought-class ship. So, that's presumably what happens off-screen, even though you don't see their discussion. What I thought was interesting about that whole exchange is, like, it's kind of veering into new territory in terms of the canon of overall fiction, or, like, ontology, I guess you would even say. It's a point at which a pre-existing story is used as, like, a stratagem and a plot point within a remake of that same story. I don't think I've ever seen anything like it before. It's like they use the resolution of an existing story to resolve a new story. It's kind of unprecedented. I thought it was actually quite interesting.
Yeah, that's cool. But I don't know. To me, it's sort of...
It's definitely a cheat. Like, it's a major cop-out. And like, the movie doesn't exist on its own terms.
And it sort of prevents me from thinking that this Spock is clever and capable of doing things on his own. You know, he just copies what happens in Wrath of Khan. So it doesn't seem like as much of a victory for Spock as it should be. So I think it's as cool as that strange new territory is. It sort of prevents that character arc from really working for me.
I'm curious what you felt about, like, the Khan reveal. I mean, I guess it was kind of like a poorly kept secret.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a lot of buzz about how, Benedict Cumberbatch is playing Khan, but I'm curious what, like, your audience reaction was, because when he says, "My name is Khan," there was, like, an audible gasp
really?
In my theater. Like, people were, like, freaking out about it.
There were some laughs in my theater, and the annoying guy two rows behind who was narrating the whole movie explaining the interplay between Wrath of Khan loudly to the person sitting next to him probably said something. But other than that, no, I didn't get the audience reaction wasn't the same. And I had already found out through just being present in, like, film blogs and things that he was Khan. So it wasn't surprising to me, no. Obviously cutting this part out.
And that's our show.
Deej, where can fans of the show find you around the interwebs?
You can follow me on Twitter at DJ Wheeler, and you can also follow me on This Is My Jam at DJ Wheeler.
You can find me on Twitter and This Is My Jam under the handle TheTravisW. If you have questions about the show or suggestions of movies you want us to review or check out, you can email that to thethirdreel@gmail.com. That's thethirdreel@gmail.com. Please rate and review the show on iTunes. It helps us be more visible in the iTunes algorithms if you do so. But that'll end the show. So, as always,
Khan!